First of all, let me begin by thanking Rabbi Goga and KTC. It's always wonderful to do stuff together and to work together. And putting this tonight's discussion together is my five-year-old one step from being a teenager. Just before we begin, I think most people know me, but just for those that don't, my name is Michal Gerari. I don't know how to do this very well, by the way, so if I make mistakes, Rabbi Goga is my technician, besides being a great educator. I run an organization called Bina, which is dedicated to adult education. But the reason I bring that in is because one of my passions over the years has been to develop a stream in our programs to share with people personal growth, relationships, parenting, all types of character development issues to do through the eyes of Jewish wisdom. And parenting is certainly a very, very crucial part of our whole life experience. I'm a parent myself. On all range of ages, starting all the way from, 26, I think. 26 all the way down to 8. So I'm still learning, I'm still practicing, which is why I like doing parenting talks, because it gives me a couple of reminders, gives me the strength to come together and to refresh all our concepts of sharpening the saw and really revisiting some of the ideas. Because it's always good, when I go to a parenting talk, even if I don't learn anything new particularly, I hope we will share some concepts with you tonight, but just getting together and focusing on parenting, there was some great tzaddikim, great righteous men who said that it's an obligation to spend a half an hour a day thinking about the education of our children. So I'm not sure if we actually manage the full half an hour every day, but at least once in a while to come together. So it's great to see everyone here, so we can spend a few minutes tackling some parenting issues. But I want to just give two introductions. First of all, we know that parenting today is, parenting generally, but today particularly, requires a whole new level of skill, right? Today, it is being said that today, children live in a world where for the first time ever, children know a lot more than parents do, particularly in the area of technology, in a serious way. We try to keep up, but we're fairly ignorant. And parenting, because of the technological advances and the communication which takes place today, parenting has become a whole new, with a whole new set of challenges and a whole new skill. Just to give you a little bit of an insight, this is a birthday cake that my sister-in-law made for my niece in the US. I mean, you never had birthday cakes like that when you were a child. Right? I'm not sure it's such a good idea, but this is the kind of thing which we have to sort of, you know. But of course, parents try to keep up. I saw this lovely message texting between parent and child. If you take a minute to read it, right? So, everyone can see it? The mother says, "Your great aunt just passed away, LOL." So the kids say, "Why is that funny?" "It's not funny, Dave. What do you mean?" "Well, mom, LOL means laughing out loud." She says, "Oh my goodness, I said it to everyone. I thought it meant lots of love. I've got to call everyone back now, right?" I'm still learning some of the acronyms. I mean, it's an incredible world. My granddaughter, I could never believe, she was using an iPhone before she could say one word. She knew how to swipe it. She knew where to find stuff. It's an incredible world. But even more important than that, a really, really important introduction to tonight's discussion is this. That parenting is not one skill, right? Parenting is multiple skills and multiple components to effective parenting. We have this concept in a Kabbalistic concept that a person's personality is driven by two, some of you heard me say this before, a person's personality is driven by two primary emotions, chesed and gevura. Right? Chesed and gevura, which means kindness. Chesed has everything to do with love and connection and bringing people close and flexibility and attraction and all the things that come under that category. Gevura is more the discipline, the structure, the restraint, discipline, all these type of things fall under that gevura. And parenting, all relationships, but parenting particularly, needs a very, very strong dose of both. One cannot parent effectively with only one or the other. So we've got to have doses of love. We've got to build up children's self-esteem, as Rabbi Goga was talking about before. We've got to create an environment that is happy, create an environment that is an environment of love, that is fun. All those types of things that fall under the chesed. At the same time, we've got to have guru, we've got to have structure, we've got to have discipline, we've got to have boundaries, we've got to have rules. And they're very, very different personalities, and some of the challenges that parents face a lot of the time is that generally our personality, people's personality, lend themselves to either one or the other, and it's very difficult to actually be both. Parents sometimes ask me, is it okay if the father's one and the mother is the other? And the answer is no, it's not okay. That just creates mixed messages. both parents actually have to be both. Both parents have to be learn the art of putting into the parenting experience multiple components, but particularly these two areas of chesed and gvura. So I say that because tonight's discussion, that's what makes a one-off parenting discussion so difficult and so challenging. Because what I want to do tonight, I want to make it very clear. I'm going to highlight one particular issue of parenting, but make it very, very clear that it will never work and it will never be effective in isolation. It's got to come together with everything. It's got to come together with a healthy environment. It's got to come together with love. It's got to come together with building self-esteem, with respect, with mutual respect, and all of the other parenting components that make up a healthy parenting experience. So we're going to focus really on one issue tonight. But remember, please remember that this is not what's going to make parenting successful. It's one critical component in the context and together with everything else that comes with parenting. So we'll have to come back next time so we can discuss some of the other stuff. So let's begin with focusing on the topic. So we're dealing with the teenager that is not really a teenager, because what we're going to see is that the personality of a teenager and the challenges of teenagers. Can I just get a general... We all have younger kids here, generally speaking. Yeah, what's the... anyone got children over 10? Yeah? Okay. So you got some younger as well? Okay, mostly we have younger kids, right? Under 10, yeah? Okay, so we're on topic here, good. Because the challenges that people have with teenaging, and teenaging is challenging, I've done it a few times now. Not I've been a teenager a few times. I mean, I've parented teenagers a few times now. They do have their separate set of challenges and they have their issues, but the issues that begin at teenaging, or the issues that teenagers have, and the parenting complications that come with it, actually start much, much, much younger. What I want to share with you is a little bit of theory. We're going to spend a bit of time on theory, important theory, which I believe is critical theory, using concepts of Jewish wisdom, and then try and develop a practical application to this discussion. So a while ago, I do a weekly email on personal growth. So a while ago, I wrote an article called It's the Chocolate, Not the Drink. There we are. Let's get a bit of chocolate there. Right. Why did I write that? Because I wrote it in response to a program I was listening to while I was driving on the radio, where they were talking about alcohol-related violence, right? Which apparently has become a real problem of recent times. So there's all kinds of suggestions and strategies that they wanted to try and put in to minimize the problem of alcohol-related violence, which is there in a community which is very young, as young as teenagers or a little bit older. So they talked about, one suggestion was to raise the legal age of drinking. Now that's really naive. I mean, people will find the drink if they need to. So obviously that's not going to help. It doesn't help in other parts of the world. I don't think it's going to help you either. The other strategy which they did before the Premier resigned was to enforce some new strategies in terms of mandatory sentencing for violence that was related to alcohol, right? Now, I don't know, it might have some minimal effect, but I think all of these strategies in these discussions miss the point. Because they're very, very symptom-based, and they're responding to a problem which they're seeing in an older community. Older, I don't mean old people, I mean older as in teenagers or just post-teenagers. And they're really failing to give some thought to what is the cause, what is actually happening that is bringing younger people to involve themselves in substance abuse or alcohol or any other type of aggression or violent type behavior that leads to those type of experiences. Now, generally when I just talk to people around the community, people seem more so than in previous years or in previous decades, people seem to be experiencing a lot of crisis when it comes to teenage parenting. Recently I was having a discussion with a parent of teenagers. You're happy to know it's not in the school, but it was... I mean, the types of things that go on, the types of precautions that people are now taking with birthday parties of their teenagers. There's security guards at doors that people don't come crash, gate crash. I mean, it's the craziest stuff. Out of control behavior. People just have lost control, don't know what to do, come crying because they really are at a loss what to do with their out of control teenagers that are engaging in types of behavior or engaging in pursuits of certain pleasurable experiences that is leading to really antisocial behavior, irresponsible behavior, sometimes violent behavior, and getting into a lot of trouble, whether they get into trouble in school or at home or the law sometimes, and it's just out of control. So let me share with you a Kabbalistic idea, which I'm going to use as the model to understand how this all works and why addressing these issues when children are older is actually probably not going to work. Well, we need to address the issue of the difficulties that you face when your children will become teenagers. Hopefully they won't be that difficult, because if we put in the right strategies when the children are 3 or 4 or 5, we create a foundation that later on, first of all, they'll be healthy 5-year-olds, but not only the healthy 5-year-olds, they'll actually grow up, hopefully, to lead much better and more responsible lives. Let's just take a bit of time for the theory and to go through a process like this. We know that we are taught that a person has two souls, two forces. We talk about the animal soul and the godly soul. These are two forces within the human being that pull us in two completely different directions. The animal soul, the role of the animal soul, is the force within us that pulls us towards the attractiveness of physical pleasure. Right? We live in a world where we're surrounded with all types of experiences, all types of things that are available for us to engage in, to draw pleasure and derive pleasure from. The animal soul pushes us, pulls us in that direction, physical pursuit, pursuit of materialism, pursuit of pleasure, a type of lifestyle that is basically sort of meaningless, has no purpose, has no depth, has no meaning, has no mission, has no moral necessarily. It's just to enjoy ourselves. Now, nothing wrong with pleasure. We'll soon talk about it. It's fine. Too. We all engage in things that are pleasurable. But this becomes the pursuit. This becomes the obsession. This is the mission. This is the pull of that force within us called the animal soul. The godly soul, on the other hand, is the force which God implanted within us, right, to pull us towards a life of meaning, a life of purpose, a life of death, a life of morality, a life of spirituality. It gives us a mission, right? That's the soul that provides us with a mission, with a moral compass, with a focus to live life with as an experience that has got depth and has got some purpose and has got some meaning. Now, let's just understand this. We need to go through this theory so we get the concept right, so that we're able to understand where we're going with this. Now, of course, there's nothing wrong in having pleasure. I mean, for example, there's a section in the Torah, a very interesting section, where the section of the Nazarite, the person who becomes a Nazarite and abstains from drinking wine and from eating grapes and from enjoying certain things that is available to him. And he goes through that as a process of purity and holiness. And at the end of it all, when the Nazarite finishes the period of being a Nazarite, he or she have to bring certain sacrifices. And one of those sacrifices is a sin offering to atone. And the Talmud says, why would the Nazarite have to, who is so holy, he went through a period of holiness, of abstinence, why would the Nazarite have to bring a sacrifice which is a sin offering? And the Talmud says, because he or she abstained from the pleasures of this world that God made available to us to enjoy, and he didn't enjoy, right? So, particularly in the Jewish religion, we engage in physicality, we enjoy God's creation, we get involved in enjoying the creation that God made for us. So there's nothing wrong with that. But when we talk about the pull of the animal soul, we're talking about a life that is solely built, that is completely focused on pursuit of materialism, pursuit of pleasure, without any deeper meaning. Right? Now we know that pleasure, unfortunately, today's society particularly, we know that statistically, and there's psychological and scientific research for this, that worldwide, generally, depression is on the rise. And it's interesting because we live in a world of abundance. We live in a world, and we're talking about in the developed world, where people have what to eat, they have things that they can enjoy, and yet depression is on the rise because one of the reasons behind it is because there's a terrible confusion between pleasure and happiness. Pleasure and happiness are two different things. Nothing wrong with a bit of pleasure, but pleasure is external. Pleasure is something you get from something on the outside. Happiness is something that comes from within. Happiness, in fact, is directly related to depth and meaning. When a person has a focus, even if they don't have much, but if they have a focus in life, they have meaning, that provides happiness. So pleasure is something which is completely transient, right? It's a feel-good moment that dissipates and normally leaves the person with an emptiness and a hole and a yearning for something more, so they engage in more pleasure, thinking that if they take more of the pleasure, they'll become happier, and it becomes a vicious circle, and that's why it brings such unhappiness and such dissatisfaction, right? Whereas, if a person just engages a life of pleasure, normally the outcome of that, the consequences of that, are things like greed and temptation, and sort of there's an unquenchable thirst. and need for more and more without ever becoming completely satisfied, because you'll never satisfy that need. That need comes from within, and you're trying to satisfy it from without, and it only can be satisfied really from an internal happiness, an internal meaning, an internal purpose. So these are the two souls, right? Now, the unfortunate part, maybe, I don't know if it's unfortunate or fortunate, is that the two drives of these two souls are actually mutually exclusive, and we actually have to choose between the two. Right? We actually cannot, there's an expression in Yiddish where they say, Mikenish tansen av tzvei chasnes, which loosely translated means a person cannot dance at two weddings at the same time. Right? Sometimes we may want to be two places at the same time, but we can't. Right? Because sometimes we have to choose. And it's actually a choice. The struggle of the human being, this is a very, very real struggle that we all struggle with every day. The struggle of the human being is the struggle between choosing a life of the animal soul or choosing a life of the godly soul. Are we going to choose a life that is just pleasure-driven, pursuit of that which is material without any focus or depth? Or are we going to choose a life where we can still enjoy God's creations, and we should, but it's got a focus, it's got morality, it's got values, it's got meaning, and there's a higher purpose to what we do every day. Right? The problem is as follows. The problem is that it's because it's a choice between an empty animalistic lifestyle and a higher type lifestyle, the choice is very difficult. We all struggle with the choice, really, on different levels. The choice is hard. The choice is hard because the naturally more, the easier one, the more comfortable, apparently more comfortable one, the easier option is to choose the pull, is to choose the attraction of the animal soul, right? And that's an obvious thing, which is why so many people are drawn towards that type of lifestyle rather than working hard to actually achieve a life of greater meaning. And this has become worse, right? Because today everything is available. Not only do we have so much available to us, which is a blessing, by the way. Not only do we have so much that is available to us, but it's available now. So today not only do we slip very easily into a life of pursuing a life of pleasure, but we've fallen into this trap. We all know the word, it's a cliche almost, but we've fallen into the trap of instant gratification, where not only do we need to enjoy life, not only do we need to enjoy things around us and have pleasure from things around us eventually, but we need to do it now. Right? Because we live in a world where there's abundance, where we can get things very, very quickly, and this increasing need for instant gratification is just growing and growing all the time. Now, if we decide to choose, if we have intelligence and maturity, and we decide to choose a life of greater meaning, a life of purpose, a life of focus, a life where we're going to make the world a better place, ourselves better people, and we're going to bring morality and values and spirituality into our lives, it takes many, many skills. Right? In order to do that, in order not to be attracted to the life that the animal soul provides for us, but rather to be attracted to the life that the godly soul is attracting us to, it takes a lot of skills, which actually those are the skills which fundamentally highlight the difference and the uniqueness of human beings as opposed to animals, for example. For example, right? It is only that one of the fundamental differences between human beings and animals is that human beings have the ability to learn from experience, right? Animals are not able to do that. We have the ability to reflect and to think and to search for truth. We have the ability to reflect on morality and purpose and goals. We have the ability to be more self-aware than animals do, right? We have the ability to consider consequences. Animals don't do that. Animals are instinctive. So an animal is attracted to something, he or she does it without considering the consequences. What's unique about a human being is a human being can actually consider the consequence. We have the ability to look at the bigger picture. We have the ability to forgive, to empathize, which are all things which make healthy human relationships. These are all true, and these are all very, very important skills if we choose a deeper life rather than an empty life. But the biggest, and this is what I want to get to, the biggest and the most important tool which gives us the ability to live a life of meaning, a life of responsibility, a life where we can make decisions between good and bad, between what's moral and immoral, between what's responsible and irresponsible, the one skill, the one tool that is critical for us to have, which is the foundation of all the other skills, is the concept of self-control and the ability to delay gratification. Right? And it's okay, because that's out of order, and that's fine. All right? This is what I wanted to get to. Let's understand this. The one tool, the one thing that a human being needs, more than anything else, is self-control. Why? Because when we're faced with a choice, and life is full of choices, and what's unique to the human being is the ability to choose freely, to choose between what is responsible, irresponsible, what is good or bad. When we're faced with a choice, what normally happens is the difference between the concept that we've been developing, the difference between the animal soul and the godly soul is that the animal soul is like an animal. It's very emotional. The definition of animals are that they're emotional beings. And emotions work, the heart works a lot faster than the head. A lot faster. So when someone insults you, or there's something very, very attractive and you know it's unhealthy, there's this delicious cake in front of you and you know it's not good for you. Or there's a choice to make, you want to say something and you know it's the wrong thing to say. You know it'll damage your relationship. Or people drink and they know that it's going to be, the consequences could be bad. But the emotional pull to that animalistic behavior is so strong and it works really quickly. And what the person needs more than anything else is that pause, that space to be able to reflect, right? And sometimes that space can be very, very small. If someone insults you and you suddenly feel like you want to lose your temper, there's a very small window of opportunity. There's a very small window where you have a few seconds to hold back, to self-control, to self-regulate, self-discipline, to make a choice whether it's a good idea or not a good idea. It's a very small window of opportunity. And it's that window of the opportunity that a human being, more than anything else, needs to learn to have. Because reflecting, considering consequences, reflecting on values and morality can only happen if we have the space in which it can happen. But if we don't allow us that space, if we're always following our emotional pulls towards things which we instinctively want and are instinctively attracted to, then all of the other skills, we don't have time to think about forgiving. We don't have time to think about how to strengthen our relationships. We don't have time to think about healthy behavior and responsible choices, because we don't have any self-control. So the self-control is the foundation of anything else that will cause us to live a responsible life, a life of depth, a life of meaning, a life of purpose. The very first failing of the human being, as we are taught in Chumash, in Genesis, is the lack of self-control. Consider this, the Talmud tells us that Adam and Eve were created and were given one mitzvah, just one instruction. You can do whatever you want. You can eat from any tree that you want. You just can't eat from one tree. And by the way, it wasn't an apple, just in case anyone's thinking, right? In fact, according to many opinions, it was a grape. And the reason I mention that is because the Talmud tells us that the entire instruction that Adam and Eve were given was to abstain from eating those grapes for 3 hours. Because we are told that Adam and Eve were created in the 9th hour of the day. Had they waited the 3 hours, they would have been able to enjoy those grapes. The grapes were created to enjoy, but they would have enjoyed it with a certain focus. Because what was going to happen Kabbalistically was that in 3 hours after they were created, it was going to be Friday night. And they were going to take those grapes and squeeze them and make kiddush and enjoy them. And the whole world and the whole future history would have looked different. That was the instruction. For 3 hours, to have self-control, and they failed. And we're still suffering from it today. Because the lack of self-control leads to everything else negative. So in a TED lecture, I'm sure you've seen lots of good TED lectures, and maybe you've seen this one too, but in a TED lecture that I saw recently, it had a great study. I'm going to show you a clip of it in a minute, but let me just share it with you, the whole study. There was a study, an experiment that they did with children who were about 4 or 5 years old. They sat them in a room. This experiment was repeated twice. It was done first in America, and then it was done in South America by the guy that was presenting it. They gave each kid a marshmallow, and they told them the following. That if you want, you can eat the marshmallow immediately. But if you wait 15 minutes, you get 2. Okay. Now you're going to see in a second what happened, but it was amazing to see how some kids had more. People are generally not born with natural self-discipline. That's part of our challenge. But some people are born with more self-discipline than others. Put it that way. Right? We all have to work on it. But so some of the kids couldn't hold themselves back and just ate the marshmallow right away. And some of the kids actually managed to wait the 15 minutes and had the self-discipline to be able to do it, and they were able to wait the 15 minutes. They then tracked them. They tracked these kids into teenagehood, into adulthood, and it was absolutely clear that the kids who had more self-discipline led much more responsible and effective lives. The ones who couldn't withstand the temptation were much more challenged later on than the ones who could. An amazing thing. Let's have a look. It's really funny. Let's have a look at just a little, a short clip of it. If I can. Oh. There we go.
Hasta para mí, de 4 años, es atractiva la idea.
Don't worry about the language. It's fine.
La inversión en conocimiento. Sin embargo, algunos de ellos, tan pronto la puerta se cerró, se volvieron en el negro
Point is clear. I don't know if you saw, but there was actually one. Nothing coming in this part of the video, but there was one child actually, when the guy wasn't looking, made a hole in the marshmallow and ate the inside of the marshmallow. He said that kid will probably be really, really high achiever. Just don't employ him in a bank or something. Why did I bring this all in? Because when a child goes older and doesn't possess the ability of any self-control, then no amount of lecturing, no amount of convincing, no amount of new laws and tougher sentences. What's a tougher sentence? A tougher sentence, by the way, could be a legislation from a government, or it could be a tougher sentence from a parent. You ground the teenager for 6 weeks instead of 3 weeks. I mean, these things simply don't help. They don't help because if a child doesn't possess that foundation ability of self-control or self-discipline, they're not able to control themselves. It's an impossibility. We're talking different languages. When you talk about considering consequences, that's an intellectual thing. When a child who's older, who makes a bad choice when they're 14 or 15, and engages on whatever level it is, if something more severe like alcohol, or even less severe at home, something destructive, engages in irresponsible behavior, it wasn't an intellectual decision. It was an emotional decision. It's an instinctive decision coming from the animalistic energy which exists within us. And that therefore there's very little chance that lecturing and explaining and all the programs that they bring into in schools and teenagers about how bad cigarettes are for you, and they show them the lungs that are so deformed and so hard. It's great stuff, and I'm sure it has some effect for some people. But I highly doubt, I haven't seen the research on it, but I highly doubt whether it really has a real effect. And the reason is because when kids get into antisocial, irresponsible behavior, it wasn't a considered decision. It was a lack of self-discipline, a lack of self-control. And therefore, educating or overcoming those challenges does not start when the child is 14. If you want children to live a responsible life, if you want them to choose a life of responsibility, of greater meaning, greater purpose, rather than animalistic life when they grow older, it's got to start from when they four or five years old. And today we look around, and I think we have, it's incredible. I mean, you know, I kind of love thinking about parenting and talking about parenting, and I'm a parent myself, as I said. And I look around, and I see all kinds of interesting things. None of you, I haven't seen you interact with your kids, so I'm sure you do a wonderful job. But I see parents in these intricate, intense, complicated negotiations where they're four-year-olds. Seriously. And normally the four-year-old wins. Like, it's an incredible thing. You know, do you want to go? Like, you give them choices. Like, do you want to leave now? You don't want to leave now. I mean, like, the parent really needs to leave and it's really important for the family to go home. Do you want to go or you want to stay? I mean, what do you mean you want to go or you want to stay? Now, nothing wrong giving choices. Sometimes giving choices is a good parenting strategy. But you don't always have to give choices. Four-year-olds need to listen. Now, let's develop this idea a little bit, okay? So you don't get the wrong idea. I'm not talking about a home where we create a reign of terror. God forbid, that would be destructive, right? A home that is based on terror is not a healthy environment, and kids bounce back later and they rebel. We're not talking about creating an environment where everything we say is no. You know, certain parents are like that. Everything is no. That's a very, very bad practice. We should minimize the amount of no's we say altogether. And we're not talking about creating a relationship with children that is based on strictness or harshness. Because today, more than ever, more than anything else, and I said this in the beginning, there's multi-components to parenting, but today children need love. They need to be spoken to nicely. They need protection. They need their self-esteem to be built up. All of that stuff. It's got to be, the whole environment has to be positive. But we often confuse the word positive with permissiveness. It's two different things. Creating a positive environment does not mean creating a balagan. It doesn't mean creating an environment where everything goes and they do what they want. On the contrary, we can be very firm and very assertive in an extremely positive way. We need to learn how to do that, and that's for a different discussion. But more than ever, we need to build a very strong and deep relationship with our children. But as Dr. Pelker would say when he was here, if you have heard his lecture, he said, he talked about relationship without rules. A relationship without rules is a destructive, unhealthy relationship, right? There needs to be boundaries. There needs to be structure. So for the good of our children, we need to, from when they're very early on, for nothing else, not because we need them to do what we need them to do, for nothing else, we need to teach them first and foremost from a very young age. I believe we need to teach children in a very positive way the art of self-discipline and a tool that they have to delay gratification, that they don't have to have everything now and they don't have to enjoy everything, but life has sacrifices, you do things sometimes that you don't like, and there are boundaries and there are self-discipline, and that, because most kids, as we saw in the videos, you could see, most people, most human beings and most children are not born with natural self-discipline. Even the ones that are need to learn more, but most people are not born with natural self-discipline. And even those that are, normally we mess it up when they get older. So it's very easy to slip away and to go away, right? So I think we need to break this down into three components. Then we'll give some examples, right? Number one is the concept of let me just get to where I was here. Oh. Right. So we talk about, first of all, not spoiling children. We live in an age and a society where children are incredibly spoiled. They need to have every single gadget. They need to have every toy that comes out. I once saw an amazing thing, by the way. I once saw a parent, that little infant, forget about when they're three or four, but a little infant, that they set up a nursery and set up a crib where there was every latest toy. I mean, if you go into a little infant shop these days, you'll find these fancy, fancy sort of gadgets. And the kid was happily playing with a wrapper, not a wrapper, like a cardboard from an electric bulb, right? For like hours, completely ignoring all the toys that were around it. And they were just happy with this little... Kids don't need all this kind of stuff. But particularly as they get older and they start to want things, and very often they want things because they see things, and they want things because their friends have things, and because everyone... Ever heard this from children? Everyone in my class has it. And every child goes home and tells their parent, everyone in my child has it. So every parent believes it, so every parent has to get it, right? And has to bend to social pressure. Kids don't have to have everything. It just teaches them that lack of self-control. Second thing is we need to... Besides not spoiling, we need to create boundaries. Boundaries are incredibly critical when kids are growing up, and it doesn't... You know, often I see parents with very, very young kids, and they really are pretty obnoxious when they're three or four sometimes, and the kids, parents think it's cute. Oh, aren't they cute, right? Now, when they're 6 months, when they're a year, when they're a year and a half, it is cute. But when they start to get three or four, it's actually not cute. Because as soon as they can understand, it stops to become cute. Because as soon as they can understand a little bit, again, it doesn't have to be harsh, and has to be age-appropriate and child-appropriate. But they can understand boundaries, they can understand things, and they have to listen, and when they do things that are disrespectful or lack of self-control, it's not cute, it's destructive. Right? So when we create boundaries, us parents, we need to know that no, I'm talking about N-O, is actually not a dirty word. So, today, we parents are actually scared, and I just read recently a whole article about this, that they sort of survey parents, they find that parents are actually scared to say no. I don't know why, but they're scared to say no to their kids. Some of the time it's because they're in public, and they're really, really scared that if they say no, the kid's going to throw a tantrum, right? So some of you heard me say this before. So what happens if you go to Kohl's shopping, and your kid throws a tantrum on the floor? So you think that everyone's looking at you because you're a lousy parent, right? But actually, tantrums are pretty healthy. They're fine. I mean, obviously, it's not great behavior, but if you go down the aisle and the child wants something and you say no, now you should maybe you shouldn't say no. It doesn't have to. Not everything has to be no. But you really don't want them to have something, and you say no, and they throw a tantrum. That is fantastic. It actually makes no difference what anyone is called is thinking about your parenting skills. If you follow through with your no, it's fine. It's great. Don't scream. Don't lose your temper. Don't throw a tantrum. Also, although sometimes it actually helps. Have you ever tried this, by the way? When a child that throws a tantrum, you get on the floor and throw a tantrum with them. Don't try this at home. But it sometimes works, right? But that's another discussion: how to handle tantrums. But children do throw tantrums, and maybe that's something to deal with later. You never deal with too many behaviors at one shot. But if it's a no, it's a no. If you decide they shouldn't have it, then you say no, and you say no assertively. By the way, children have great antennas. Normally children, not always, but normally children throw tantrums when you say no because they detected an ambivalent no. They think it's a no that's not really a no. It's a no that could be negotiated. So maybe they can throw a tantrum and negotiate the no. If you say no calmly but really assertively and you really mean it, normally you avoid the tantrum to begin with, right? But people negotiate. I've seen people negotiate with four-year-olds, trying to persuade them to do something, giving them a choice, giving them a reason. And as soon as they start to cry, okay, you know what, I'll give you my iPhone, you can play with it, you can look at a video. You don't need to do that. It's okay for a child to cry. In fact, crying is healthy for the lungs, by the way. It's not. A great rabbi once told me this. When I got married, he said, when you have children, don't forget, crying is actually healthy for the lungs. You don't always have to jump up just because a child cries. Now, children will cry and they learn. I'll tell you a great story that I once, when I was beginning parenting. By the way, I only tell you the stories that worked. Obviously, it doesn't mean I'm a model parent. A lot of times it didn't work and I failed, so I'm not going to tell you those stories, right? So I'm going to share with you a few stories of success, but it doesn't mean that I always had stories of success. So I remember my oldest son, who was turned out to be a pretty good boy, thank God, but he was about 4 or 5, I think, and we had the system. I remember we were living in Old South Road, then we just come to Australia not long after we came. And we had the system where, because children, by the way, are excellent manipulators. They want structure, by the way. They actually crave structure. I don't know if you know this, but they want discipline, but they challenge you. It's like a funny psychology. I'm not quite sure yet why that happens, but that's what they do. They challenge you, but they don't want you to listen to them. So my little son, we had the system that every night, and again, every parent has their own values and structure, what they need to do at the home, but every night, if they said Shema nicely before they went to bed, I'll tell them a story. So then I ran out of stories, so I stopped doing that, so I don't do that anymore. But then I used to do that. So he went worked for a few nights, and then, I don't know, the fourth or fifth night, he challenged me. And he started clowning around, not saying Shema properly. So I gave him one warning. I said, okay, no problem, but nicely. I didn't scream anything. I just said, you need to say Shema nicely. If you don't say Shema nicely, there's no story tonight. So he clowned around for another minute. And I said, okay, no story tonight. He started to howl like I almost failed. Almost. I thought he started to hyperventilate. Almost. I thought he was hyperventilating. Right? And he was, I'm sorry, I'm good, I'll say Shema. And he sort of like pulled at my heart. I felt so cruel. And I kind of just knew, I don't know, I must have gone to parenting lecture the week before or something. And I just knew that, no, I'm not going to give in. And I didn't. And he went to sleep. I don't know if he said Shema or not at the end, but he went to sleep and he was huffing and puffing from this tantrum that he threw, and it never happened again. Seriously, never happened again. Never had a problem with the Shema. Why? He saw the first time in business. That's it, finished. Because I said no, he screamed, he shouted, he threw a tantrum, he pulled at my heartstrings, he almost got me to fail, and I didn't, thank God. Because had I failed, the exact same thing would have happened the night after. You mean business, you say no. It doesn't have to be done harshly, it doesn't have to be done strictly, you need to talk to children with respect. but it needs to be assertive because they need to learn self-control. It is critical for young children to learn discipline. Positive discipline, but inner discipline, inner self-control. Now again, no has to be a careful thing. We should minimize the amount of times we say no, but if we say no, we need to do it, we need to follow it through till the very, very end. And of course, we're going to go through some more examples in a minute, but of course the most important part, and I know this sounds a bit cliche, but it's so important because when you talk about parenting, you have to bring this in, is that we have to model self-control. Children will not learn self-control unless we model self-control, which we'll talk about in a minute. So let's just give a couple of examples, right? One of my favorites is this. Have you ever seen young children leaving with parents, like leaving a carnival or a park, and they don't want to leave? Anyone knows what happens? What do you do when your child doesn't want to leave the park? Right. Sorry? Yeah, and what if they don't come, by the way? Right? Children aren't stupid, you know that. They know you're not going to leave them there alone. Right? Unless you're really prepared to do that, right? I'm not recommending, I'm just saying, right? Children are very, very clever. Now, one of my favorites is this. You know, you say, okay, you better come, otherwise it's going to be a consequence at home. All right, I'm going to count to three. Some of you heard me say this before. I love this. You ever heard this? Okay, I'm counting to three. One, two, a child ignores you. Two and a half, two and three quarters, two and seven, eight. Please listen, like, please, you know, like, please, like, you're pleading with the kid. The kid's laughing at you, right? Now, everything needs to be child appropriate. Obviously, children in parks, children at carnivals need preparation, right? It is really unfair for a little child. In fact, it's almost world-shattering when a child is having a great time at a park to suddenly wake up and say, okay, go now, you know, it's time to go. That's not fair. So things need to be age appropriate. Children need warning. You just say, okay, you know, we're going to have two more rides, or we're going to have two more minutes, or whatever, you know, in children language, you know, two more sleeps, like children say. But whatever it is, they need warning. But then the warning has to be followed through. If you say you're going to count to three, don't count to 17. Count to three. And if there's a consequence. And if they're small enough to say, just to pick them up and leave, that's what you do. If they don't leave, we're going now. We need to go now. It's not negotiable. It's not dependent whether you're upset or you're calm. It's what we're going to do. That's what's happening. Right? And children need that. They need clarity. They suffer from ambivalence. And they don't learn the art of self. They learn they can navigate the system and they can override the system. And it's just very, very unhealthy. Right? A real big issue today, and I wanted to bring this in and discuss it for a few minutes. A real big issue that is so critical to the art of children learning self-control is the amount of time they sit in front of A, doesn't matter what it is, iPad, television, video screen, whatever the technological thing is, right? It's and it's very, very tempting. Because there's no cheaper and greater babysitter than a video, right? It's much cheaper than hiring a babysitter, and it's just much easier. They glue to the screen, and they go for it, right? But it's now, and also, you know, some people regulate what their children watch, and that's a good idea. That's a responsible parenting thing to do. And everyone has different standards, and that's fine. So people sort of soothe themselves. We soothe the unconscious by saying, well, they're watching good stuff. It's educational, it's Jewish, it's kosher, whatever they're watching. We now know, and it's scientifically proven, right? It's a scientifically thing that the passivity that kids lapse into, when they sit for extended amount of times in front of a screen, there are lots of studies now that link it with violence at a greater age, antisocial behavior, obesity, all the types of things we don't want our children to engage in come from sitting, and it fries the brain. It just dulls their whole senses. Because the old-fashioned sort of going out and being children need creativity. Children need to go out and just figure out what to do. Lounge around, think, be imaginative, right? The extended amount of times that they sit in front of the screen is extremely damaging for children, no matter what they're watching. And no matter how hard it is for them not to do it, it's something we need to teach them from a very, very young age. I've seen parents when as soon as their children become edgy, they give them an iPad or they put them in front of a screen. It is the most destructive thing we can do. Now, it's okay. We have available to ourselves all these things. There's some great programs, some great educational stuff, and we should let kids watch stuff, whatever your standard is, whatever you choose to let your kids watch. But it needs to be regulated, and it needs to be from a very young age. They need to learn the art that you don't watch it whenever you want and however you want. Besides the right, we need to actually just take it away, and we need to force kids to be, as they get a little bit older, they'll say, "But I'm terribly bored. Like, I don't know what to do." That's great. Be bored. Just be bored and find what to do, and you'll see how creative they are. As soon as they get the message that for this hour, for these 2 hours, there is no screen, they will find what to do. When they're very, very young, it won't be a problem. They'll find what to do right away. Even when they get older, they will find what to do, and they will be creative about it, and the creativity will be extremely healthy for them. So, if we're talking about implanting in children this art of self-control and self-discipline, this is one of the key ones. We absolutely have to limit the time they sit in front of the screen. Besides the point that we now know, and there's, again, the studies that prove this now, I just read an article recently about it, but I've read tons of articles about this, that one of the consequences of overexposure to any screen is the whole concept of family meals has gone out the window. Now, thank God we have Shabbos, so that's sometimes just like something we have to do, so we have that sometimes, but there's an incredible value of children interacting with each other and with parents sitting down to a meal. Now, not everyone can do it. Some fathers come back late, some mothers come back late, whatever the case is, but we need to try as much as we can. That's another discipline of the family that children need to know. They have to come to the table. You can't just go and even read a book. You can't just do what you want. I've got an issue now with my youngest, who's, thank God, loves to read and started devouring books. That's the age. They started sort of exploring. But even that, which is fantastic, much better than the screen, infinitely better, right? But even that has its limits. You can't just do what you want whenever you want. And we have a thing now that when I come home, just this evening, she was upstairs. She had already eaten because she was hungry. I came back a little late, and she was upstairs reading. I called her down. She's got to sit with us for 10, 15 minutes, whatever the case is, because just for no other reason, just the self-control. There's a discipline. There's a structure. When I come home, we sit together. It's also good. We catch up with the day. We ask what's going on. How was your day? What did you learn? What did you do? What happened at school? These small interactions are incredibly healthy. But apart from the other benefits, there's the benefit of there's a structure. There's a boundary. You just can't do anything all the time. Another one that's really incredibly important in terms of creating boundaries is respectful speech. This is a huge thing. Unfortunately, kids pick up, I guess, from, I don't know who, but from everyone. All the way from the politicians down to the people in the street, that it's okay to talk to people disrespectfully today. And we know in Jewish sources, if one looks at the laws of respecting parents and just general respect for people, the laws that govern the way we speak to parents, the way we, the hierarchical relationship of understanding that there's authority, we have to respect authority, the way children speak to parents today is atrocious sometimes. And parents are at a loss what to do. Again, it starts off from when they're very, very young and people think it's cute, and it very, very travels from being cute to being really destructive. It's a whole other discussion of how to actually manage that, but one thing parents need to know, they absolutely have to put their foot down. When children talk disrespectfully to them or to anyone or to each other, but particularly to parents. I mean, when we were kids, we were taught you never sit in a parent's seat, you never interrupt a parent. Now, it doesn't have to be I'm not talking about in the context of children were made to be seen. How does it say not to be seen, not to be heard? That's disgusting. But there is a respect. We need to listen to children. We need to give them room to talk, but that needs to be done respectfully, and we need to teach them that respect, because that respect for authority, that concept of hierarchical relationships, from a Jewish point of view, is so critical. Not all relationships are friends. We need to be close to our children, but we're not our children's friends. We have a role. Our role is to impart values. We are symbols of authority at home, and they need to respect that. Again, not in a harsh way, but it needs to be very, very early on built into the house that self-control. You can't just say whatever you want. So these are just a couple of examples, but obviously, again, it goes to the third concept. The third concept is, and that's the big question, that it only really works if children are able to witness parents exercising and demonstrating self-control, the concept of modeling, right? They need to see us talking respectfully to each other. They need to watch us managing our own anger, our own temper. If we lose it with them every time they push our buttons, that's not great self-control either. Now, it's very difficult. I mean, you know, sometimes I want to strangle them. But nevertheless, we need to think about that. Sometimes, you know, sometimes we become better people just because we start thinking of what the impact our behavior can have on our children. And just generally, the big question is this. The big question is, and this is what we need to reflect, going back to the two types of lifestyles. What type of lifestyles do we choose? Even if we are, you know, keeping mitzvot or doing the right thing and leading pretty good lifestyles. But we know that a moral lifestyle, a life of meaning and purpose, is a life of growth. And the question we need to ask ourselves also is, do our kids ever see us going beyond our own comfort zone? Even if we're good people. But do they ever see us struggling to do more than we've done before? To become better people than we've been before? To do another mitzvah that we haven't done before that we know we should do? Or whatever the case is, do they see us growing? Do they see us going beyond our comfort zone? Do they see us self-regulating and making responsible decisions to grow as better and more meaningful human beings? Because when we do that, it is infinitely more powerful and the impact is infinitely greater than lecturing and teaching and talking, right? So when we, or what? How do they see us handle times when we want something and we need it now, we lose patience because we don't get it right away? When we're driving in the thing, how do they see us handle someone cutting us off? How do they see us even trying to get onto a website and the internet is down that day and it's frustrating because it doesn't come up as fast as it's supposed to? I mean, it's unbelievable. We just have to think. We all of us would remember when we had dial-up, right? Remember dial-up? Right? Where we had to wait 5 minutes to get onto a website? We were fine then. But yet today we know that we get it instantaneously and as soon as the internet's a little bit down. I know in the office, you know, I'm screaming out to the guy, Yaakov, like, why? What's with the internet today, right? And then I said, hold on a second, relax. I mean, this is a luxury, right? You know, or if we get stuck on a runway for 15 minutes, you know, like we have the ability to fly, we can go to the other side of the world, but 15 minutes late and we're cursing out the pilot. So how do our kids see us handle those situations where we don't get what we want instantaneously? So the third part of instilling into our children that ability of self-control and self-discipline is our own modeling. How do we regulate ourselves? And we need to answer our own question and try and improve in that area so that we're sending that very, very powerful message. So the summary of this is as follows. We saw from the video, not everyone is built with self-control. When our children in Mirtz Hashem reach a teenage stage, they will have their own set of issues and we need to have separate teenage discussions. But we can minimize a lot of the future issues by dealing with a teenager now. It's the foundation of life. We model children, I think psychologically they say about time a kid is 7, they sort of have their personality model. Now, it's never too late and there's always hope and we can always do stuff. But the formative years are really, really crucial. They're really crucial for every area of parenting. And again, parenting, we can talk about it for weeks and months. But the concept I wanted to bring out tonight is this one issue that I think some of what's lacking nowadays is a realization and an acknowledgement that this is an important issue. That from a very young age, we need to create that ability, which is so lacking today in society, to delay gratification, to have self-control, to respect boundaries, to understand that there's rules and structure, and to learn that art of inner. Normally, it comes from outside first, it's taught, but then it develops as an inner, internal self-discipline. It's, as I said before, it's not the drink, it's not the alcohol drink that they have too much when they're older, it's the chocolate we give them and spoil them when they're young. And if we can tame that and we can train that and we can instill in our children that ability to self-regulate and to have that self-discipline when they're young, we'll give them a foundation, a healthy foundation. There will still be issues along the way, but we'll give them at least a strong foundation to be able to have that space to make moral decisions, to make responsible decisions, and to lead a responsible life. Thank you for listening.